taking you on your grief journey from A to Z. That's literally impossible. And we would not in any way want to suggest that the topics that we're looking at this afternoon, that you ought to be there, because grief is a journey that you're the one that walks through. But what we do want to look at this afternoon is to look at, as you go and deal with your own grief, that there's some things that you have to deal with. J. William Warden, in one of his books, says that there's four major tasks of grieving. And again, they're passing these out, so you'll get this in just a moment. And these seem simple, but yet, I guess when you're dealing with whatever loss you're dealing with, and again, that's the important thing. Remember that grief is caused by many other things than the loss of just an individual. But the first thing is you have to accept the reality of the loss. And that means either that you accept not only the intellectual acceptance, but also you accept the emotional relationship of that loss. That takes time. Just like I illustrated this afternoon about, or earlier this afternoon, about the lady that was wondering, what am I going to tell my kids after 42 years of being married to that man? The same is true in regard to whatever grief loss that you're dealing with. It takes time. You have to emotionally accept it, and you have to intellectually accept it. It would be easier for me to say one is easier than the other, but for each person, it's different. Years ago, I had a lady whose husband was killed very tragically, very suddenly, and because of several circumstances involved in the actual accident, she never was able to see him. She struggled for years. Her head told her that he was gone. But emotionally, she never had any closure, because she was not able and not allowed to be him, be with him for any period of time or see anything about him. And see, when you're dealing with, and years ago when we were in Kentucky for a workshop, a lady told us about a situation in which she had family members that were killed in a plane crash, and tragically, they could not find the plane. They were flying toward Colorado and got stuck in a snowstorm in their plane. And because of the snowstorm, it buried the plane, and they couldn't find them until later the next year. And she said, my daddy lost his mind, literally. And she said, we grieved wondering for 6 months, that's how long it was, until they were able to finally find the plane crash and then those inside. But said, we wondered everything about what could have happened. Had they been kidnapped? Had there been a mistake somewhere? I mean, she said, I went through every scenario possible in my mind. By the way, she told us, she said for, I think it was 2 years after everything was found out, she said, I could not pray. I went to church. I didn't miss a service. But I just could not, in my mind, respectfully pray, because I didn't know what to say. I didn't know what to do. And said, my church stood with me. They were there for me. But she said, and then she added one little caveat. She said, anytime they offer the book of Job for us, the Bible study, I go somewhere else. I cannot handle Job to this very day. Can you see what she was dealing with? Intellectually and emotionally, she just could not handle certain things. And I have an idea that some of you in this audience would understand that and would see that. And because grief, I mean, we never know when grief's going to hit us. I mean, it's like the wave of the ocean when you're out there and you're, you know, everything's calm and everything's good. And then all of a sudden you turn your back and all of a sudden it just wipes you out. And you say, where'd that come from? Well, that's the way grief is sometimes. Song leader did a great job today. I loved his songs. I've had people have to get up and walk out because of songs that were sung that reminded them of their loved one. We had a lady that told us one time about her husband, who was a song leader of the church, and she said, the elders of the church, the elders of the church, after he died and after the funeral was over, the elders came up to me and said, out of respect for your husband, who had led singing there for, I think it was like 40 years, we have asked our other song leaders not to lead, and they had a list of songs that remind us of him out of respect for you. And then she looked with a big old grin to her face. She said, don't I have a great church? And we told her, you sure do. You've got some really compassionate, thoughtful elders. Well, you see, they understood. And probably, it not only would she be grieving as they sang those songs, but others would likely be grieving as well. But you have to accept the reality of the loss. Some people want to deny the facts of the loss. Others are tempted to deny the meaning of the loss. And then others, like the lady I mentioned earlier, deny the irreversibility of the loss. Number two, they have to learn to experience pain. No one volunteers for pain that I know about, except when you have to go through surgery. Do you ladies know what pain is involved in regard to having children? There are certain surgeries that involve not only the pain from the surgery, but then afterwards the rehab that comes with it. Don and I both have had knee replacement surgery, so we know about rehab from knee replacement. It is no fun. But it was also no fun when the lady told me, as she was crunching on my knee, if we don't get this knee working, we're going to have to go back and do something else to it. And she told me what she was going to do, what they were going to do to me, medically speaking. I started getting white and sweating profusely. And I said, just go ahead and keep crunching. You know, we're not going to get there. Well, in regard to grief, you have to learn to experience the pain. And pain hurts. And it's real easy to want to run and hide. It's very easy, and COVID sort of helped, or I guess contributed to this issue, of saying, okay, I'm going to get back in my little castle, my house, and I'm going to stay away from everyone else, and I won't hurt anymore. Wrong. You're either going to hurt with or without people. That's just the way it is. And that's why we need people. Okay? Number three, we learn to adjust to the environment in which the object is no longer present. This takes time. Warning to the ladies, if your relationship in your life is sort of being the catalyst that makes everything else move in your world, and if you try to find value in your relationship with others, warning here, if you don't learn to facilitate and deal with this pain, then you may be headed to either tremendous anger or tremendous depression. So just be careful about this one. And then number four, they withdraw some of the emotion that they've invested and they put it somewhere else. That does not mean you forget. It means that you've chosen to live and honor them by what you do in your life. The last two sections there, the signs of moving toward the future, the four primary indicators, all are different events of dealing with people that want to get better in regard to bringing family back together again. Regrouping of the family, cleaning your house, having the first meal back together again. You'd be surprised, and this is no reflection on widows, because widowers would probably be even worse. But there is a temptation when widows have to, once they begin to deal with the real adjustments that they have to make, they start asking the question, why should I clean my house? Why should I clean the sheets on the bed? After all, I'm the only one that sleeps there. I had in my class a group of widow ladies, and they without knowing it, had a contest of how long it was before they would cave in and wash the sheets on their bed, because many of them reasoned, well, I'll just sleep to the other, I'll go to the other side of the bed and it's clean there. 39 days, that was the record. They all caved in, and finally the last one did at 39 days. But it's this idea of saying, okay, I've gotta do something different. You begin to focus on other people's needs. You begin to realize that you can handle emotions without being totally exhausted. Your relationships with friends become renewed again, as well as new friends. And notice that number seven, the returning ability to have fun without feeling guilty. I'm not talking about the life of the party. I'm talking about just laughing. Because so many people tell me, I feel so guilty when I laugh. But think about it. Your loved one likely were the people that would have wanted you to laugh. Four indicators, very quickly. Physical sensations begin to ebb and flow away. The sadness begins to mellow out, and it becomes less painful. You can go without dwelling 24/7 on your deceased or your situation, and you're able to take that pain and reinvest it in others. Don's going to come and give a survey of about 600 families as to what they did to help people in grief.
Somewhere in some of your paperwork, I want you to write down two words if you'd like to do so. Two words just side by side. Grief is. That's all I want you to write. But sometime, perhaps tonight or later on this week, or sometime when you have a moment, think about what grief is to you. We've talked about it from other ways. I'm about to read to you what one lady said, but you need to personalize it. And so sometime, maybe at home, wee hours of the night, can't sleep, write down what grief is to you. Because what it is what it is to you. I want you to listen to this lady. In the Webster's Dictionary, grief means a cause of such sorrow, suffering, a mishap, a disaster. Since May 22nd, 1999, at 7:55 p.m., not only has suffering been a part of my daily life, but that day was the worst mishap and the greatest disaster of my entire life. Sorrow is something that awakens me in the morning. It follows me everywhere all day, and it goes to bed with me at night. People say, well, stay busy. How much busier can one be than to take a college computer class, go to a grief support class, stay active in church, and help people less fortunate than I? I feel sad for what I have lost. I feel poor for the empty space. I cry for what I cannot have. I am restless, for my life is not whole. However, you cannot abandon the ship simply because you cannot control the winds. I am not going to give up on God. I am going to thank Him for what I have left. When you hear that statement, what thoughts come to your mind? What do you hear in the statement that she wrote? Hope? What else? I'm sorry. Solitude. Faith. Reality. She saw it both ways, but her end result was, I'm not going to give up. And I love the way that she put it. Simply because I cannot control the storms, I'm not going to give up on God. The fact of the matter is, in Psalm 107, verses 27 and 28, the Bible basically says God's either going to still the storm or He's going to calm His child. Psalm 107, verses 27 and 28, you might want to read that sometime. That even in the midst of the storms, God is there. Remember the date that she gave, the time that she gave, when this was the worst mishap of her life? That was what's so interesting. You see, this lady lost not one husband, but two. The first one was a sudden, unanticipated drowning in a boating accident at the age of 25. The one that was the worst mishap in her life was the death of her second husband after 9 years of cancer. So that's interesting, that the anticipated loss was greater to her than the sudden one. She told me the story that after that husband of cancer died, he had been in their home in a hospital bed for years. And she said, I just couldn't go on into that room, so I just closed the door. The dents made by the hospital bed were in the carpet, and they just spoke too loudly to me. And so she said, I just had to close the door. For a couple of months, it stayed that way. One day, the 5-year-old grandson came over to visit her. And as she was there and he was walking in, he said, why is Poppy's door closed? And before she could answer, he just barreled into it, opened the door, walked in, and began to talk about all the fun times when he sat in Poppy's lap there on the hospital bed, and they played games together, and they told stories together, and of all the good times that he remembered. And she said a 5-year-old did in 30 seconds what she could not do for 60 days. Remember him, not how he died, but how much he lived. And so that door remained open. In common, what you have before you, 600 families who have gone through the grief journey have said, first of all, they find someone to share their grief with. That doesn't necessarily mean another mate if you lose a child. Studies show that folks who have lost a mate suddenly, it's going to take longer, if at all, that they choose to remarry because of the sudden, unexpected loss that they had to deal with. But for some folks, it's just the idea of finding a place where people will accept them for who they are. For some, it may be a new church. For others, it may be the church that they are at. Heard about this lady at a nursing home. This man came in. He was a new male resident. She walked up to him and said, you look like my third husband. He said, third husband, how many have you had? He said, two. Sometimes that may happen as well. We've had three situations, at least that I know of, in the last 30 years. And there may soon be a fourth where widows and widowers came to our grief class and the 10-week class and then ultimately fell in love and got married. That's not the reason for the class, but if that happens, then so be it. I knew of a lady who had four Christian husbands. Two of them were brothers in the flesh, but all four of them were brothers in the Lord. And she had married, and then they died, and then married. And anyway, you know the story. At age 86, she came to me after the fourth husband had died and said, "Brother Don, you think you can find me another husband?" I told that story to someone, and somebody said, "Who wants to marry her? You're going to die." Secondly, to make a decision to move on. Moving on is not forgetting. You're not going to forget. Your only concern is that others will forget your loss, and hopefully we won't. But you make a decision to move on. Again, there's a long time between the loss and that decision. Thirdly, they clean up relationships. The older you get, I think people realize what's really more important. And sometimes we deal with petty issues that really aren't that important when we think about it. And after 9/11 and the suddenness of that terrible disaster, some families begin to have weekly reunions, not yearly reunions, because they just realize how terrible life could be and how terrible it can be taken away. Folks who make it through grief journey become forgivers. Ephesians 4, verse 32, you be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another. Why? Even as God, for Christ's sake, has forgiven you. You know some people who are long on memory and short on forgiveness, and that's sad that we live in that kind of world. But I read the other day, he who cannot forgive destroys the bridge that he himself must one day walk. So it's really important that we do that and that we be willing to try to forgive as best as we can. Of course, enter into that is the idea of a person that is sorry for the things that they have done as well. Number five, they become amends makers. F.H., one of my favorite teachers, and I bet the same was true for you, was Dowell Flatt. Wonderful man of God from the state of Tennessee. Hickman County or somewhere over that way. But anyway, I was taking the book of Philippians, Paul's Epistles 2, I think it was called. And he made this statement in Philippians chapter 4, verse 5. It reads, "Let your gentleness be known unto all men. The Lord is at hand." And he said, fellas, that word gentleness literally means be willing to meet people halfway. And I thought how important that is, that we try to do our best to meet people where they are and to try to help work with them so that we can make amends. And then number six is so, so very important. Folks who make it through grief learn that in giving, they receive. You see, first of all, grief has to be a mirror. Each of us look at ourselves in the mirror and we see what grief has done to us. And we know better what grief has done to us than anybody else. Now, they too can see it, but not nearly as much as we do. We want it to be a mirror as long as it needs to be a mirror. There's no time frame for you to move on, if you will. It needs to be there as long as it needs to be there. But what you want to do is to be able to work through your grief, struggle with your grief, begin to try to get past getting by, to try to get better, and allow the glass to turn outward so it becomes a window. So that through the window, you see the hurts of others. And you also see your own reflection in that glass. Right now, for many of you, it's a mirror, and it needs to be a mirror. And you need to allow it to be a mirror as long as it needs to. But in time, let it turn outward so that you're able to see the hurts of others. You see, in this room today, there are people who will be able to touch folks and help people in ways that Ron and I can't. We haven't had the loss or losses that you have. We know something about the loss of parents, But there's other losses that we haven't experienced. And yet some of you sadly have. And out of that, you might be able to help people and at the same time help yourself. In the Florence area, the Tuscumbia, Alabama area, where Helen Keller lived as a little child. And if you ever get a chance, in the backyard of the home that she grew up in, they do the play where she spells out the word water on the literal place there where it was. She made this statement, "As long as you sweeten someone else's pain, life is not in vain." Bill McDonald, Ron mentioned him one time, helped us get started in this journey. And he was not only an elder and a counselor, but a funeral director, and he was working with a lady who, months removed after the loss of her husband, wasn't willing to get beyond just the enormity of that situation. So as a counselor, he did something somewhat dramatic. He said, "I don't want you to come back to me until you're ready to talk not just about his death, but now what you're going to do about it." Now, as a counselor, he made that bold decision. So for a couple of months, she didn't come. Finally, one day he heard her before he saw her. There was an outside office, and he heard her voice out there talking and laughing with the ladies. And so he saw her, and he walked to the door, and she had this big smile on her face. And he invited her in. He said, "You look so good." She said, "Do you have a new dress?" "No, no, no." And she said, "I want to talk to you." He said, "Okay, is it your hair?" He said, "No, no, no, it's not anything." He said, "I want to talk to you." He said, "Okay." So they sit down, and she said, "Last night, Bill, I decided to make 12 dozen chocolate chip cookies." "Oh, you're in a sugar high." "No, no, no, that's not right." She said, "I made those 12 dozen cookies. I put 12 of those aluminum pans out. I put a dozen here, a dozen here, a dozen here. And then after I finally filled them all up, I wrapped them up. And I took them to 12 families that I thought needed them." What had happened? The grief that was a mirror had turned into a window. She could see others. And while she helped others, the reflection was also there of seeing herself and how she could help others. Along a country road one day, a little boy was walking. And as he walked along, he saw this big sign there at the end of a lane, "Puppies for sale." So he walked up the lane to where the man was, and he said, "Sir, I hear you have some good-looking puppies." He said, "Yes, they are." He said, are they expensive puppies?" He said, "They're registered puppies." He said, "Well, I've got 39 cents. You reckon I can see one of your puppies?" He said, "Sure you can." So the man said, "Come on, Dolly." And here came the mother dog behind them, these fat, furry puppies. And they were just running behind the mom. And then he looked back and he saw one puppy that was a lot slower than the others. It took a while for him to get up to where everybody was. And the little boy said, "Sir, you've got some mighty fine puppies here." He said, "Yes, I do." He said, "That last puppy, how much is that one?" He said, "Son, you don't want that puppy. It was born with a bad leg. It can't run and play like others." He said, "That's not a puppy that you want to buy." Little boy reached over to his pants leg and pulled it up, and you could see a steel rod from the bottom of his foot all the way up his leg. He said, "I know what it's like not to be able to run and not to be able to play. That puppy's going to need somebody like me who understands. Sir, I want to buy that puppy. How much is that puppy?" And the man said, "There's no price for love. It's yours." Sometimes, out of the fragile existence that comes our way, that's not our fault, that we didn't cause, we're able to see and help others, and that in giving of ourselves to others, we're able to receive. Number 7, Those who make it through grief learn to live in the present moment. Over in Philippians chapter 3, you've got Paul talking to that church that he loves so very much. And he makes a statement over in verses 13 and 14 about this idea of forgetting. Forgetting those things which are behind and reaching forth into those things which are before. I press toward the mark for the prize of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus. Forgetting those things which are behind. Think about what that meant to Paul, who was Saul, the persecutor, who thought he was doing God's bidding by going into families, hauling out Christian moms and dads, putting them in prison, some of them perhaps even being killed, holding the garments as they stoned Stephen. All of those things were a part of his life previously. He had been forgiven by God through baptism, but he said, forgetting those things which are behind and reaching forth in those things which are before. Folks who make it through grief learn to live in the present moment. Many of you in this audience have a phrase that goes beside your name. You are creative survivors, or the one I really like is wounded healers. Henry Nguyen came up with that concept because you have the wounds, but hopefully you're in the process of healing. And you have to be creative concerning the survival that you deal with. Number 8, folks who make it in grief share their new feeling of life. There is light at the end of the tunnel, the hope is, and they try to share that life with others. William Faulkner wrote the book Wild Palms, and in that he makes a statement, between grief and nothing, I will take grief. Think about the seriousness of that statement. Between grief and nothing, I will take grief. Or Alfred Lord Tennyson, he put it this way, it is better to have loved and lost than never to have loved before. Those are statements that you have to live with, that you have to answer. I'm thinking of a lady right now who, after the sudden loss of her 21-year-old son in a car accident, said, I can't agree with that right now. Right now, it's too painful. Right now, I can't say it was better to have had him for 21 years, only for him to be snatched away in this terrible moment. I haven't seen her lately. I'd like to ask her if she feels differently about that. But the fact of the matter is that we were on this earth for some reason. And we're all living our dash. You know, you go to the cemetery, you see the name of the people. If they've died, you see the day they were born, the dash, and then the day and year that they died. Besides our names, there's the dash. God knows when it's going to be, but we don't. And so it's up to us to live that dash the very best that we can. Earl Groman, a Jewish rabbi, put it this way, the greatest monument you will ever erect is to live a life of meaning and purpose in honor of your loved one. I think we'd also say in honor of God, in the midst of the tragedy, to be able to honor them and to be able to honor God by living that dash to the fullest that we can. My hope is that something we have said will be of some help to you in this moment and also throughout the time that we've been together. We're going to take a little break because everybody needs to be in their pew. And we're going to give you a chance to do that if you haven't already gotten where you need to sit. Congregation I used to preach at, pews were sacred. I mean, you know, people, that you know, they had their blankets there, and they had their little, you know, fans, and you know, you didn't tamper with those. You know, the folks in the back, we just charged them more money because they get those first. No, just kidding. but everybody needs their pew. The final lesson during our service, we'll talk about 10 things this congregation can do to help in times of grief. For time's sake, you're going to have two sheets. One of them is already going to have a list of 25 things for time's sake, but we'll give you a few more. But we'll just take a little break, and then we'll come back in just a few minutes. Thank you.